everyone, and welcome to a Sportspiel special. This week we've taken a diversion away from our normal format, and we'll be bringing you a full-length discussion show on some sporting issues that have come up this week. Of course, some things have remained the same in that I am here, and opposite me, Will Moulton is here. Are you all well?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm slightly disappointed that I didn't have a guest this week, but through very, very, very little fault of my own. But we're here for a special. We're going to be even more insightful than normal, if that's possible. So stick around. It's going to be good.
Yes, we try our best to be insightful. People have told us that we can be.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But anyway, in front of me, on my lovely piece of paper, I have our agenda for our discussion podcast today. First up, we're going to address the Rainbow Laces campaign and the wider issues around it. We're then going to move into the fast lane and chat Formula One as the season draws to a close. There's then going to be a football-focused final two topics as we dissect the BBC's latest Price of Football study, before concluding with a chat on the importance of testing for heart problems after Manchester United captain Michael Carrick revealed he underwent a procedure to correct an irregular heart rhythm. Additionally, we also have two features to go through: our outstanding display of the week, plus our feel-good story of the week. All that and more on this Sportspiel special. November 24th to the 3rd of December is Rainbow Laces Week in the UK, part of Stonewall's campaign to raise awareness and show support for LGBT sports fans and players on and off the pitch. Avid sports viewers this weekend can't have missed rainbow colours adorning their TV screens, but is the message getting across? Here are some statistics, courtesy of research from insight agency ICM Unlimited and publicised by Stonewall. 72% of football fans have heard homophobic abuse. 63% of people say more should be done to make LGBT people feel accepted in sport. 63% of young people say that open LGBT players would have a positive impact on the culture of sport. And 55% of sports fans say they wish more sports players felt free to come out. With all that in mind, let's kick off this discussion by asking, are rainbow laces enough?
The whole rainbow concept, I think, is a good concept, and it's just a shame that it's only for 1 week a year. In some ways, you'd like to have it all year round. I don't think it's not going to be enough to stop the minority who are homophobic, who do make it difficult for people to come out. You hear week in, week out of Brighton and Hove Albion football fans, their team, their players, the fans themselves receiving homophobic chants from other supporters because of the stereotype of Brighton as a place, as supposedly attracting a lot of homosexual people, which it might do, it might not. It's, you know, it's a difficult one to tell. I don't think the laces in this campaign 1 week of the year are going to be enough.
Speaking of Brighton, Liam Rossinia, who plays there, he wrote an article in The Guardian, which I thought was really interesting, and it was entitled, "We Need a Culture Shift, Not Just Rainbow Laces for Players to Come Out." And he kind of talks about how society has come to be very accepting of people's choices in that regard, but particularly in football, there's still this macho dressing room culture. And he says footballers essentially need to start asking questions about themselves and their day-to-day practices. For someone who may be gay to feel safe that they can come out in that environment, do you think it's probably a culture shift that's maybe needed?
Yeah, massively. Culture shift, not just among the players, but among everyone in football. There's a reason why very few players have ever come out, and most of them have come out post leaving the game. I don't know if it's the players themselves or the fans, though. I mean, for me, you see the way footballers conduct themselves on social media, and I've never seen anything that would suggest any footballer is homophobic or is deliberately putting across homophobic views on social media. You never see that, but it's always the fans. So for me, that's where that cultural shift seems to lie. But if he believes that's the, and he knows better, if he believes that's where the change needs to happen, then perhaps there is something that we don't see that's going on.
I think the fans issue is quite a big one as well, because we know what football crowds can be like. They can't, if you're a player, referee, whatever, It's not often the nicest atmosphere to be in if you've got someone hurling abuse at you, and if they know someone is gay, they'll probably use that as a target.
It's also a cultural shift in just terms of normal society as well. We hear so many people end up using the term gay as an insult for someone who does something, and they say, oh, you're so gay, and it's...
We're past that.
We should be past that. But you hear 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, and they don't know what they're not deliberately, you know, being homophobic, but they're learning it from somewhere. So that shift needs to happen, and then the football fans, and then the athletes. There's a lot that needs to be done, and Rainbow Laces are a good idea, and I love what Stonewall campaign is trying to do, but they need help.
Exactly. You need more than just laces. But there's one other point that I want to sort of talk about, and that's in reference to an article that was written by yours truly, myself, last year, when I was researching and writing about the campaign then. And this came up as a key factor. Young people are twice as likely to say anti-LGBT language is harmless if it's meant as banter. Banter is something I like to call Richard Keys syndrome as well. Now, for that article, I interviewed Ben Biggs, who's the chairman of Stonewall FC, and he said one of the things Rainbow Laces is trying to highlight is that while you may consider it banter, that does have a real impact on you if you're a gay fan or a gay player. Now, personally, I hate the word banter because I think it's too often used as an excuse, and it explains away people's insults a lot of the time. Should we kind of be looking to redefine what banter means?
Yeah, like you say, the word banter used to be, you know, a word for dressing room jokes, but now it's become synonymous with, like you say, an excuse for not just homophobic but sexist, misogynistic language as well.
I actually took the time to write out the definition of banter in the dictionary.
Oh, did you?
The playful and friendly exchange of teasing remarks.
See, then I would say telling someone, I don't know, I don't really want to use an example, but I would say some of the stuff you hear in changing rooms isn't teasing or playful. It's offensive to certain people. And I know, you know, the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Words do hurt people, and people are sensitive, and we shouldn't be... Yeah, those sort of insults, like I said earlier, 7, 8-year-olds... going around calling someone gay because they've done something stupid, that shouldn't be a thing. And it is.
That's the thing. Like, I think banter in itself is fine as in its defined term, but it's become this catch-all
It's become phrase. A buzzword, hasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. If you're insulting someone ever, it's just banter. And that it's too often used to explain away things. So my final point is that I think this homophobic language kind of has to be treated in the same way that racism has been treated, because it's relatively recently we're looking back at crowds dishing out all manner of horrendous racist abuse at players, and it's become unacceptable in football culture now. So you really need to get homophobic abuse treated in the same way by lots of other fans.
I mean, it's not just football, it happens in other sports as well, but obviously football is the one where it seemingly happens more often. But I think if you're going to get homophobic abuse kicked out of sport, there needs to be a surefire sort of sport-wide strategy, which there isn't at the moment. So as hockey, we tried to... we got in contact with Stonewall. We were going to do the Rainbow Laces campaign, and we've got... Our girls are out at a tournament that concluded in New Zealand this morning as we record. We sent them out with the Rainbow Laces. They were really, really keen to wear them. We then got in contact with the FAH, and the FAH said they have no policy on it. So they said we couldn't wear them just in case someone got offended or upset by it, which is ridiculous. Like, there needs to be... You need to have a policy. This Rainbow Laces is quite a big thing now.
It's not just a UK-based thing now. There's the rainbow symbol, if you like.
If they said no because it was some form of political stance or something, then maybe we could have understood. But just because they said there was no policy... And they're not the only sport. It's just... There needs to be something. Everyone needs to get their heads together and do something.
And use common sense, essentially.
Yeah, a little bit.
But anyway, moving on into the fast-paced world of Formula One. And if you didn't know, today, that Sunday, as we record, is the final race of the season with the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. which hasn't started yet as we record this. From the perspective of a simpleton who likes overtaking and speed and who doesn't really understand too much about the technicalities, i.e. me, this season looked to be shaping up into a classic tussle between Mercedes Lewis Hamilton and Ferrari Sebastian Vettel. However, in the second half of the season, Vettel and Ferrari sort of imploded.
And there was no sort of, they have imploded.
They imploded. And Hamilton wrapped up his fourth world driver's title with ease. So I ask, was the season a disappointment?
Yeah. I mean, even when at the start of the year you had Hamilton and Vettel trading wins, they were never really battling with each other much on the track. Actually, the last few races have been quite interesting because both Hamilton and Vettel have had to fight back through the field. They've had a couple of really tasty duels with each other. And then you've had Max Verstappen thrown into the mix with two fantastic wins as well. So actually the last few races have been fantastic, but that's after the title's been sorted. I think Singapore was the key moment at the start of the race when Vettel took out himself.
Oh, that was very entertaining.
Ricciardo and Raikkonen with a ridiculous move and handed a win to Hamilton when that really should have been a Ferrari victory. They then had reliability issues after that, and then it's all gone downhill. So the season's been exciting. It's just not quite been the epic we thought it was going to be.
I think it's had its exciting moments, but I don't think the season as a whole has been too exciting.
It's had a few races that have really stood out.
But the overall narrative has kind of disappeared.
Yeah, which is a shame. What we all wanted to see was Hamilton and Vettel having really dicey battles, but with the way the cars are set up, it's either one dominates at one track or one dominates at another track. It's never been they've had similar cars, they've been battling it out tooth and nail. If they ever had on track action, it's always been one's been passed within a couple of laps and then they're off disappearing up the road. Mm-hmm. Which is a shame, but that is the way Formula One is at the moment.
Yeah, and to sum up the gap, before the final race of the season, I've got the point tallies in front of me. Hamilton top on 345 points, Vettel second on 302 points, then it's Bottas on 280 points, Ricciardo 200 points, and the Constructors' Championship, which is probably quite a marker of how far Ferrari fell behind Mercedes. Mercedes are top on 625 points and Ferrari on 495 points. Vettel said this week that Ferrari have learnt from their mistakes. Do you think they have and will?
Well, they need to because they haven't won a title in a long, long time now, and certain people up the top are getting a little bit frustrated and a little bit trigger happy in terms of firing bosses. And there's now rumours that Ferrari could be leaving 2021 with the suggested changes. And Formula One without Ferrari, as much as I despise Ferrari, it's not a sport anymore. Ferrari
it's iconic.
Is Formula One, really.
Exactly. You grow up with Michael Schumacher driving around in that red car.
As frustrating as it was for them to be dominating when Schumacher was in charge, Ferrari...
It's just Ferrari, synonymous.
You lose Ferrari, you lose all those Italian fans. Italian fans are so passionate. Monza is a wonderful track, wonderful atmosphere, and you lose that.
It's like taking Man United out of the Premier League, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, Formula One is a dying sport with the way cars are going and everything. Formula One isn't going to be around forever in its current state. But you don't want to kill it off just yet. You want to try and prolong it.
That would be nice. But as we sort of delve into a little bit of a season review, I have some questions. First up, who was your driver of the year?
I think there's only one choice, to be honest, but we'll come to that in a minute. But there's been plenty of good efforts going on this year. So Nico Hülkenberg in the Renault. That Renault isn't that strong a car, but he's put in a good year. He consistently out-qualified, outpaced Julian Palmer. When Julian was in the car, he's picked up a good haul of points. They could move above Toro Rosso this weekend with some points. And he's qualified top 10. He's pushed that car beyond the limits of where it should have been all year. I thought both the Red Bull drivers have had really, really good years. Daniel Ricciardo with a race win, Max Verstappen with two fantastic race wins recently. They just need a decent engine under them because they've got a really good chassis. They just need that Renault engine to move up a level and be more reliable. I've been really impressed with Esteban Ocon. I know we said it in the very first episode after
way,
the first
way
couple
back
of races.
We said that.
He's had an outstanding year. He's quite possibly a world champion of the future, but you've got to go with Lewis Hamilton. He's dealt with everything that's thrown his way this year. It's not been straightforward. It's not been easy. And yet he still walks away with the title with four races to spare. So he's been on another level.
Likewise, I have Hamilton on my list as well, despite his, you know, his perks of private jets and whatnot. He is rather good at
his actual driving.
He is rather good at his job. I will concede that. Now onto probably the more fun award, worst driver of the year.
I'll run through all my disappointments. So Renault and Honda engines and their lack of reliability.
That was farcical.
Renault in particular in recent weeks with Toro Rosso have been very worrying. Considering McLaren are moving from Honda to Renault next season.
More fun and games for that team.
Pascal Wehrlein, so long been touted as then the future of Mercedes. He's had a poor season at Sauber. He got a couple of points finishes, but also Marcus Ericsson, who isn't that good a driver, as I've said before on this show, has outqualified him and outperformed him. He's also been overtaken by 17-year-old George Russell now in the Mercedes, which is fantastic for Brits, but for him it's just disappointing. Ferrari have been disappointing, Vettel in particular in recent weeks. But as much as I don't want to pick on a Brit, Julian Palmer.
Likewise, he is my worst driver of the year.
As I say, Hülkenberg outperformed him, and you thought, oh, perhaps it's because it's a difficult car to drive and it's suited to Hülkenberg. But then Carlos Sainz has come in and has pushed Hülkenberg really closely. In the same car Palmer was driving.
If you effectively lose your job mid-season, it's not been a great year for you.
He did hang on and he did get a points finish, but then they gave him a £5 million payout and he decided, actually, I'm just going to take the money.
Take the money and go. But he didn't seem comfortable in the world of Formula One. I thought his interviews were always
catchy. He started having a go at journalists, and a career's ending when that happens. I mean, he clearly has something about him. I know I've worked with motorsport journalists who don't rate him, but to win the GP2 title, even if you're in the best car, is still a difficult feat because of the just unpredictable nature of young drivers, and it's chaos. I love GP2 and Formula 2. It's absolute chaos. So he must have something about him, but it's just not worked out.
I just don't think he could really handle the mental pressure as such. It'd
be interesting to see where he goes now. I'd like to see him go to something like World Endurance Championship, because I have a feeling he could do really well in that. So
out the spotlight a little bit, I think, might suit him a little bit better.
Williams potentially looking to sign him for next year, but I can't see that happening.
On the subject of signings again, Felipe Massa is retiring once more. We did the farewell rehearsal last year. Now that we're doing the proper farewell, who do you think is likely to replace him at Williams?
It's a tough one. I think they're banking on Robert Kubica being fit. He's got a test in Abu Dhabi next week. He's done a couple of tests already. It's difficult to know what they're thinking in terms of he's only got partial movement of his right hand, so I'm not entirely sure what they're thinking, but in the tests he did with Renault earlier this season, he was on pace.
If Kubica does come back, that is one of the most incredible stories.
Superb. We definitely have to get him on the show.
We'll try.
They're also they're looking at Daniel Kvyat, which I think is I think he's proved that he can do it,
but not
often. Paul de Resta, it would be nice to see him back from a British point of view, but he's low down the list. Pascal Wehrlein, I can't see him going, and you never know, they might spring a surprise. I mean, I always rated Alex Lynn, who was on the Williams driver program, performed really well in GP2, but he's now gone off to WEC, the World Endurance Championship. I can't see him coming back, so we'll see.
We will see. But anyway, that race is happening in about an hour and a bit for us. But we'll end this first section of this Sportspiel special. We'll have a little break and we'll come back and discuss the rest of the topics in part two. Welcome back, everyone. Part two time. And we're going to turn now to the BBC's annual Price of Football study, which was released back on the 15th of November. The expensive nature of watching football has been a massive bone of contention for fans, and as the results prove, you still have to fork out plenty to watch 90 minutes of football. The full lists and prices for all UK clubs across 13 divisions are available on the BBC website, but here are some of the eye-catching numbers. Of the Premier League's cheapest available season tickets, Arsenal's, again, is the most expensive at £891. Meanwhile, you can get a season ticket at Huddersfield for £100. Man City, so a select few from the Premier League. Man City can get £299 a cheaper season ticket. Chelsea, £750. Liverpool, £685. Man United, £532. So I ask, are we in England, Premier League fans, paying too much for our season tickets? Or tickets in general?
It all depends on how you look at the stats, because the way it's been reported is that actually 80% of ticket prices have been reduced or frozen in the Premier League.
Which kind of sums up, for me, how high they were in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, did you say Man City the cheapest was
£299?
I mean,
yeah.
Arsenal have moved into a new stadium and they're still paying that off. But Man City have also moved into a new stadium, and yet you can spend a significant amount less to watch a title-winning team.
Well, also, my side, West Ham, have moved into a new stadium as well. Slightly different arrangement in that we've got the deal of the century in terms of paying for rent. But part of the plus points of that stadium, I know it's not to everyone's taste, was lower ticket prices. And the cheapest season ticket there now is £289. Whereas I think at Upton Park, it was around the £600 mark. So that was one good point to come out of it.
Yeah, and yeah, it's just, it boggles the mind how so many people can afford to go to football.
It also boggles the mind about the lack of any logic in this, right? So, in the Championship, division below the Premier League, Norwich City, £499.50 is the cheapest season ticket you can get for Norwich, who aren't
well,
exactly
were a Premier
doing
League
all that
team.
Well. Who were a Premier League team, but are now, I believe, around 15th.
Yeah, there's a lot of moaning about their new manager, Mr. Farke.
Mr. Farke, who we've mentioned before on this, actually, haven't we? But I look across Europe, and here are some of the giants of European football. Borussia Dortmund, cheapest season ticket, £189. Bayern Munich, cheapest season ticket, £125. Barcelona, £87. Paris Saint-Germain, £357. But, side point, you can buy a matchday ticket at PSG for £8.96.
Well, you can buy a matchday ticket at Liverpool for £9.
But there is a parameter with that.
Yeah, I think it's...
You have to be in the Liverpool
that's
area.
That's what I was going to say as well, is that these season tickets, that's just to watch the game. It also doesn't factor in the travel. Travel to, especially if you, like myself, you support a team that isn't from your area. Travelling to and from a game is expensive. And then how I don't understand how so many people, when we're in times of austerity and, you know, we've had recessions over the last few years, and how people can still afford to go and watch football.
Because it's not easy
when the
to get
when
out
the what the average wage is 20 something thousand pounds a year,
exactly,
which isn't a lot when you, especially if you're paying rent or a mortgage or something.
So there are a couple of people I was speaking to a few years back who were Arsenal fans, so they lived locally, so Essex area. And it was cheaper for them to fly to Dortmund and get a match day ticket at Dortmund and buy a beer and all that, have a day out, than it was to travel on the train into London and pay for an Arsenal ticket.
It's
what would you rather do?
The
fan experience is probably going to be better in
football
Dortmund as well.
Football has gone nuts. Now, it really has.
It has gone nuts. I mean, some of the fan protests did work last year, because remember the away tickets were capped at £30 last season.
But the cheapest you can get is £28.45 for an away ticket. So they're still expensive.
And it's something I find strange, because this has been mooted a number of times by club chairmen. Club revenue, particularly at the higher end of football, mostly comes from broadcast deals now. It doesn't come from match day revenue. So I struggle to find the excuse as to why ticket prices are so high when the large majority of your income comes from television deals.
I mean, in the sport I work in, the majority of our income does come from ticket sales. So we're hosting the World Cup next year. A large proportion of our income over the next year that isn't funded is coming from the ticket sales for that event. So I can understand potentially slightly higher ticket prices. But like you say, in football, the broadcast deals and everything are what... That's just people being greedy. It really is. The Premier League and the owners just being very greedy.
That word sums it up in a nutshell. It is greed. I have a few more curveballs to throw at you, mainly because I sympathise with this when I was living and working in Scotland. Forfar Athletic, who play in Scottish League One, that's the third division. Cheaper season to get £180.
Poor.
Brechin City, Scottish Championship, but I've been to their ground and one side has a hedge. Cheaper season ticket, £200. Now I compare that to the WSL. Now, I know people go, oh, women's football. But I think it's quite a good watch myself. We've talked about it a number of times. And we know the amount of games you get for your season tickets is reduced. But you can get a season ticket at Everton for £25. And you can get a season ticket at Liverpool for £30. Man City and Chelsea, so the two most recent WSL champions, be it Spring Series or proper WSL. Man City is £55, Chelsea is £42.
It's not bad, is it?
I'd pay that money for, what, you get nine games for that, and for some good quality football as well.
I mean, yeah, if you're going
and
to see...
And parking space.
If you're going to see Man City and Chelsea, you're seeing half, most of the England squad.
You're guaranteed some of the best.
Other international stars. You could have seen Carly Lloyd last year, one of the greatest footballers to have ever walked the planet. For £55 a season.
So yeah, if there's anything the Price of Football study shows us every year it's done, is the greed at the top end of the game, and I can't say I'm a fan.
I mean, it's good that ticket prices are starting to come down, but it's not by a lot.
It's not by a lot, and you look at people's wages, it's not nearly enough for people to actually afford it. And I believe I wrote this down somewhere, that I think one in every four people now goes to watch live football once a month. So that says it all, I think.
But you still see packed out grounds week in, week out in the Premier League.
People fork out for it. I can't deny that. But greed keeps floating around at the top of the game.
Indeed.
But anyway, we move on now to cardiac screening, which has come to light after Manchester United captain Michael Carrick revealed he hasn't played since September because of an irregular heart rhythm. He underwent a cardiac ablation procedure to correct the issue, and he now says he is healthy, but it underlines just how important it is to keep tabs on your heart's health. But, you were telling me earlier, a study from the University of Toronto has kind of called into question the need for screening.
Yeah, well, we had a few incidents, unfortunate incidents over the last few years of players suddenly experiencing cardiac arrests. So you had Fabrice Muamba, who had
one,
that heart condition, which the cricketer James Taylor then had, and somehow, don't know how, he didn't go into cardiac arrest.
But it forced him to retire.
But he forced him to retire, and he has a pacemaker fitted and everything. And there have been other examples. So there's been a lot of calls over recent years for more cardiac screening in sport. But yeah, this study from the University of Toronto has actually rubbished that and says that 80% in their study, that 80% of the sudden adult on cardiac arrests in their study, you couldn't have picked up pre-screening because with cardiac screening because they just were random and happened. They also cast out some other previous suggestions. So one thing that was linked with the sudden heart attacks was hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a hereditary heart condition where the heart muscle is abnormally thick. But they only found that in 2 of 16 cases that was a cause. And also arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, which is another hereditary condition where the heart muscle turns to fat. And it's also been linked to these sudden cardiac arrests. There were none of those cases. But what they did say was that actually we don't necessarily need the screening, but what we do need is the defibrillators at every ground and more than one. So 44% of the athletes who had the cardiac arrest survived largely through the intervention of these defibrillators. And that just makes a case in point. The only reason Fabrice Muamba survived was because there was a heart specialist happened to be at the ground.
The luck he had was off the scale. Incredibly lucky that.
But that's what you now need. Defibrillators are quite easy to use, and they're very successful at getting people's hearts to go back into rhythm or bringing them back from the dead, in inverted commas. It should be standard practice. There should be one at every sports ground, no matter whether you're professional or not. You should have three or four at every sports ground if you're a professional. So that's what basically their study is saying, that actually pre-screening, not only does it not often detect what's going to happen, but also it could stop people with heart conditions but at a low risk from taking part in activity because everyone's going to be worried about them, when actually they're at less chance of sort of, well, they have the same chance as us of just having a sudden heart problem.
That's the thing, it can just surprise you so quickly. And that's one thing we can all agree on, I think, is that defibrillators at every ground is essentially a must. if you're ever to avoid situations like Fabrice Muamba, and I know there's other cases that across Europe and the world where players weren't as lucky as Fabrice Muamba was.
I mean, it's only one study, and there's someone we've both been in university education, we've both had to, you know, do study analysis and that, and you can't just take the results of one study and take them as gospel. But I think what they're doing makes sense, in that you can try and be proactive and try and prevent these cases from happening, but as I say, 80% of the time you have to be reactive, and you have, and by having defibrillators there, it is also it's also being proactive in terms of your preparing yourself for the risk.
Better safe than sorry.
And the chances of it happening are very rare, but when it does happen, you need...
You'll be thankful that it's there.
I'd rather have someone play the game they love and not be held back because of something... It is almost sort of taking a risk. And you don't want to be taking a risk with people's lives, but also there's only so much worrying and preventative measures you can do, I think.
Exactly. So take full advantage of the evidence that is on offer, essentially. But we'll move on now to our final little section, and these are our feature awards, which I think we're going to make these a running theme.
Definitely.
From every podcast from here on. So we have two awards. We don't have plaques or medals or anything to give out. This is just, you know,
not as if we're ever going to meet
celebratory awards. We've got an outstanding display of the week award and a feel-good story of the week award, and on this Sportsbill podcast, Will has decided to dish out the Outstanding Display of the Week award. Who does it go to?
Indeed. So, as you regular listeners may have known, we've had two women's rugby stars on, Marley Packett and Kay Wilson. Kay Wilson has recently retired, as we discussed at length. Make sure you listen to that. It's one of my best ever interviews. England women's rugby, 15-a-side, played their first game since the World Cup this week. Three tests against Canada, missing a few big players. So Kay Wilson have retired, Vicky Fleetwood, Lydia Thompson, who's up for Women's Rugby World Player of the Year, Emily Scarrett, Mo Hunt, and Amy Wilson-Hardy, all playing seven, so they were all missing. So a lot of new faces came in, and they've caught the eye as England thrashed Canada in all three games. One player in particular stood out, and that was Jess Breach, who scored 11 tries across two games, six on the debut, including scoring a try with her first touch in international rugby. I mean, and also the tries weren't walk-ins. There was one that in particular stands out for me. Crossfield kick from Zoe Harrison. She jumps up, takes the ball spectacularly and runs into the corner. She bursts through tackles. She was darting in and out of defenders. She's also really good defensively. She's only, 18, 19 years old, but she's a really, really exciting talent. I've seen her around at Bisham Abbey a couple of times over the last couple of weeks. She seems like a really lovely girl as well, and... Yeah, 11 tries in two games. In comparison, I know I don't play international rugby, but I scored one try in 23 games at school rugby in the same position on the left wing. She's played 11 games internationally against Canada, one of the top five teams in the world, and she scored 11 tries. So
I wonder why you didn't get picked.
Yeah. I was also too short.
And anywho, well done, Jess Breach, for winning our Outstanding Display of the Week award.
First one as well.
First ever Outstanding Display of the Week award. And now on to Feel Good Story of the Week award, which I'm dishing out. And this goes to Ryan Colclough, who plays for Wigan. You may have seen this do the rounds on social media, because Colclough scored twice in Tuesday night's game against Doncaster. He then got a sign from his dad, who was sitting in the crowd, that his wife had gone into labour. We were debating what that sign was, but apparently it was just a nod.
He said it was a nod.
Yeah. So he finds out his wife has now gone into labour. He got substituted in the 60th minute, just a couple of minutes after he scored his second goal, and pegged it as fast as he could to hospital. And he arrived just in time to see his son born. Now, a picture of him... still in his full kit from that game, obviously went all over Twitter and Facebook, and it was of him holding his newborn son in his arms, and that is definitely our feel-good story of the week.
With all the moaning that goes on about footballers, it's so nice to see something
that
like that.
That was lovely. But anyway, that concludes this Sportsbill special discussion section. Hope everyone enjoyed. Before we leave you, we'll just fire over some parish notifications. As always, you can follow us on social media. That's Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. All our handles are SportsBuildPod, and you can always email us whatever is on your mind. Our email is sportsbuildpod@gmail.com. One final parish note. You may have you heard this last episode. How's Movember going across the table?
Movember is going fairly well. The Tash has now started to spring into life.
There's not many days left now.
No, there's... it runs till Thursday, the 30th of November. Then it comes off, but you can still donate to me there after then if you wish. Thank you for your donation, my friend.
That's okay.
I also need to donate to myself, which I will do, I promise. But yeah, if you would like to give me even 50p, it would be much appreciated.
Go over to his Facebook page, and I presume it's on your Twitter as well.
Go over to my Twitter page because it's easier to see than my Facebook.
Donate away. Anyway, that is all from us this week. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time. Enjoy life, everyone. Until then, bye-bye.